to start this morning with a gathering song. It's number 1018, Come and Go With Me. And we have some wonderful jazz players who have joined us this morning. So we hope to get you up and excited as we start our service this morning.
Come and go with me to that land. Come and go with me to that land. Come and go with me to that land where I'm bound. Come and go with me to that land. Come and go with me to that land. Come and go with me to that land where I'm bound. There'll be freedom in that land. There'll be freedom in that land. There'll be freedom in that land where I'm bound. There'll be freedom in that land. There'll be freedom in that land. There'll be freedom in that land where I'm bound. There'll be justice in that land. There'll be justice in that land. There'll be justice in that land where I'm bound. There'll be justice in that land. There'll be justice in that land. There'll be justice in that land where I'm bound. There'll be singing in that land. There'll be singing in that land. There'll be singing in that land where I'm bound. There'll be singing in that land. There'll be singing in that land. There'll be singing in that land where I'm bound.
Please be seated. Did we wake you up? Good morning and welcome, and a special welcome to those who may be with us for the first or second or third time. Each week, you are invited to come and go with us, to go together on a journey of the Spirit to a deeper place of freedom, of justice, of compassion and love, to a place of singing, of connection, of support, of celebration. We're honored that you're here with us to take the journey this morning. And now, as the McNeil family comes forward to light our chalice, I invite you to turn to the words of the covenant, which we'll recite together. They're printed in your order of service. Love is the spirit of this church, and service its law. This is our great covenant, to dwell together in peace, to seek the truth in love, and to help one another. This morning, I'd like to invite you to rise again in song and embracing those joys and struggles of our lives. Sing hymn number 100, I've Got Peace Like a River. I'd like to invite Ingrid Holcomb and Evan Daisy forward now to participate in our little ritual about the UU principles. The seven UU principles are values we share as a congregation. They give us our identity and draw others to join us. When we say we affirm these principles, we're saying that we give them our stamp of approval. When we say we will promote them, we're saying we try to live by them and help others to accept them and also to live by them. So today, Ingrid and Evan will introduce one of the principles and tell you just a little bit what it means to them.
This fall, we are focusing on the seven UU principles. Today, we celebrate the second UU principle. We affirm and promote justice, equity, and compassion in human relationships.
Another way to say this principle is, We believe that all people should be treated fairly and kindly.
And I'd like to say a few words about what this principle means to me. Justice reminds me of fair play and due reward. Equity is impartiality, balance, and open-mindedness. Compassion is awareness and concern for the situation of another, where I do want to do something to take away the pain the other is facing. For me, the sum of justice plus equity plus compassion can be the traditional golden rule: treat others as I wish to be treated. But as I grow and change and make new friends from places that I have not experienced, I have come to use an altered version of that golden rule: treat others as they wish to be treated. In the days ahead, we ask you to be conscious of this UU principle and to think about what it means in your own life.
Please join us now in saying the words of the second principle as printed in your order of service. We affirm and promote justice, equity, and compassion in human relations.
Today we're going to go on a journey together to some faraway countries. We'll travel over seas, wild seas. It's an exciting adventure with something important to teach us all. So let's get started. It's going to start like any good story starts, and who knows how that is. Once upon a time, there was a farmer who lived in the northern kingdom of Israel, and his name was Jonah. And one day when Jonah was resting, out of nowhere, a voice spoke to him.
Jonah, this is God talking. Get up and go to the great Assyrian city of Nineveh. The people there have become very wicked. You tell them they have 40 days to change their ways, or I will destroy them.
Oh, gee whiz, God. Why me? They are not going to listen to me. You must be crazy. Those people are my enemies. They have done horrible things to us. I don't have any desire to save them. I don't want you to forgive them. Why don't you just destroy them without any warning? That's what they deserve.
Hey, God.
Are you listening to me? Why don't you answer me?
But God did not reply, and Jonah was angry.
No way am I getting involved in this. I'm getting out of here. I'll run away to some far-off place where God can't find me.
Jonah went to the harbor, and there he found a ship ready to sail, and asked the captain,
Where are you going?
To the far-off city of Tarshish.
Oh, great! I think that's far away enough. Here's some money. Will you take me with you?
Get on board.
Soon they set sail, but once they got out to sea, trouble started. There was a terrible storm with huge waves. It tore the sails and cracked the mast, and the boat was in danger of sinking. The crew was very scared. They'd never seen a storm this bad. They throw their cargo overboard to make the ship lighter, but things only got worse. Then the captain gathered his crew. They were all from different parts of the world and believed in different gods.
This storm must have been sent by the gods. They must be very angry at one of us. Let us each pray to our own God to end the storm.
That didn't help. Then they remembered Jonah, who, can you believe it, was below deck sleeping through all of this. The captain brought Jonah on deck, and the sailors all viewed him suspiciously and said, It's you, Jonah. You brought this terrible storm upon us. Who are you? What have you done?
I am a Hebrew, and I disobeyed my God who told me to go to Nineveh, but I ran away instead. That's why we have this terrible storm. Cast me overboard and save yourselves.
The men did not move to do so. They rowed harder and kept trying to keep the ship afloat. But finally the captain said,
Jonah, it's no use. We must throw you over, or we will all perish.
So they threw Jonah into the water. And instantly the storm ended and the sky cleared. Jonah floated around in the ocean for a while and didn't know what to do next. Before he knew it, the water was swirling and he was being drawn into the mouth of a whale. The whale swallowed Jonah, and Jonah was in the belly of the whale for 3 days and nights. He thought about all the good things in his life, and how he should have done what God told him to do. He prayed a lot that he would somehow get out of the whale's belly. And then all of a sudden, the whale gave a big heave and Jonah flew out of his mouth and onto the land.
Wow, that was a wild ride. I wonder what I should do now.
Go to Nineveh, Jonah.
Oh yeah, all right, I get it. I'll go. I'll give them the warning, but I still don't think you should forgive them.
So Jonah went to Nineveh.
Wow, this place is really big and really bad. These people are evil enemies. No way should they be forgiven. No way are they going to change. This is crazy. But I'll do what God told me to do. Pretty soon, they will all get what's coming to them, and I'll be done with this crazy mission.
So Jonah went to every corner of the city and told them that they had 40 days to repent or they would be destroyed. And the people listened and said, "We have been cruel and dishonest and committed many crimes. We deserve to be destroyed, but perhaps if we change our ways, God will forgive." And then the king of Nineveh spoke.
"It is true. I have ruled badly, and the people have become evil and corrupt. It is time to change. I will take off my robes and crown and wear sackcloth and ashes instead. And everyone, even the animals, must do the same. And we all must fast and ask for forgiveness and do good deeds."
And everyone obeyed, and God forgave them and did not destroy their city. Everyone celebrated except Jonah. He was angry and left the city and sat on a rock in the sun to pout.
"God, I can't believe you did this. This isn't fair. They should have been destroyed. They deserved it. I've had it. Why don't you just take my life? I want to die."
"Jonah, do you think it's right to be so angry about my forgiving the Ninevites?"
Jonah did not answer. He just continued to be angry and sit in the hot sun, hoping it would just destroy him. But one morning, Jonah woke up to find a beautiful tree had grown up, which gave him shade. Jonah sat under the tree and enjoyed the shade. But the next day when he woke up, a giant worm had eaten the leaves and killed the tree. So right away, Jonah called to God.
"God, why did you send that worm to eat the tree? I feel sorry for the tree, and I'm angry that you killed it."
"Jonah, do you think it is right to feel angry about the death of this tree?"
"Yes, I do."
"However, you didn't plant the tree. You didn't take care of it. You know I watched over the people of Nineveh for a long time, and they were slow to learn right from wrong. You were concerned about that tree, but shouldn't you have had the same love and concern for the people of Nineveh? There comes a time to forgive, and holding on to anger like you are doing will only make you miserable. Think about it, Jonah."
And that's our challenge to all of you today, to think about it. Thank you, performers, especially God up in the balcony.
Anytime, Tom.
Well, as most of you know, I can't resist to share either a bit of humor or a good story or a catchy quote as a way to inspire your generosity each week. And with the construction that's been going on here at church and the way the jackhammers have been shaking our building, I'm reminded of this true story. I shared it with a few of you over the summer, but I think it's a good one and it deserves a in-season sharing. So anyway, it seems that there was a rather run-down church, and the pastor of that rundown church was desperately trying to raise funds to fix it, and without much success at all. One Sunday morning, he saw the richest man in town sitting in one of the pews. So at the offertory, when he was doing what I'm doing, he looked right directly at him, and he made an impassioned plea. And as if on cue, a small piece of plaster fell out of the ceiling and landed right by the man. Seeing the urgency of the situation, the man stood up and said, "I'll give you $1,000. And just as he did, another piece of plaster fell and this time hit him on the shoulder. The man brushed himself off and said, "I'll give $10,000. At which point the pastor looked to the heavens and said, "Hit him again, Lord." Well, I promise we won't use that technique to raise funds here. But this, I hope we won't anyway. Actually, having decided when I was preaching in Mexico last time, the ceiling fell down beside me. So, anyway. But this church does need your continued generosity. The morning offering will now be gratefully accepted with some wonderful music.
There is no freedom, the wise man said, let justice roll down, roll down. When the poor cry out for shelter and bread, let justice roll down like a mighty stream. Oh, children, don't you get weary. Walk together, believe in the dream. When the way gets rough, we can make a new way. Let justice roll down like a mighty stream. Hatred will never drive out hate. Let love roll down, roll down. Remember our hearts can make us great. Let love roll down like a mighty stream. Oh, children, don't you get weary. Walk together, believe in the dream. When the way gets rough, we can make a new way. Let love roll down like a mighty stream.
When brutality threatens our daughters and sons,
let peace roll down, roll down.
May our voices ring out above the guns.
Peace roll down like a mighty stream. Oh, children, don't you get weary. Walk together, believe in the dream. When the way gets rough, we can make a new way. Let peace roll down like a mighty stream. When fists rise up to strike a blow, let songs roll down, roll down. May the poets remind us of what we know. Let songs roll down like a mighty stream. Oh, children, don't you get weary. Walk together, believe in the dream. When the way gets rough, we will make a new way. Let songs roll down like a mighty stream. Step by step and one by one, let justice roll down, roll down. They can kill the prophet, but the dream lives on. Let justice roll down like a mighty stream. Oh, children, don't you get weary. Walk together, believe in the dream. When the way gets rough, we can make a new way.
Let justice roll down.
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 Let justice roll down. Like a mighty.
You just heard those wonderful words from the Hebrew prophet Amos. Let justice roll down like a mighty stream, sung by three of our youth so wonderfully. They could be our theme song. We as Unitarian Universalists have a long history of being involved in social justice. More than seeking personal salvation or individual piety, we've sought to reach beyond ourselves, trying to truly build a society where justice rolls down like a mighty stream. We pride ourselves on our involvement in the women's suffrage movement of the late 1800s and early 1900s, in the civil rights movement of the 1950s and the 60s, the gay rights movements of our own time, and the peace movements of several times. All these were efforts to bring equality and fair treatment to an excluded group, and thereby make a society more just. I think we all yearn for a society where every person is treated the same under the law. A society that's fair to everyone, where everyone has the same rights and those rights are respected, where everyone has the same opportunity. I think this is what comes to mind, at least for me, when we say that we affirm and promote justice. And as an abstract principle, it sounds great. But as is the case with all our principles, articulating them in the abstract is easy, but living them in our lives and applying them to our society always gets messy. Be it on the level of country or nations or in our individual relationships, people regularly violate the rights of others. They act in ways that hurt others, that demean others, and they do things that are morally repugnant, that are wrong and break down the bonds of society. You know, in the words of the Jonah story today, they do things that offend God. And when that happens, there's a cry for justice. But what we often mean by justice here is different from that justice I was just speaking about, that abstract idea, that goal we hold for our society. No, this cry for justice often takes more of the form of a demand for punishment, retaliation, even for revenge. It's the kind of justice that Jonah feels the Ninevites deserve. Jonah's not happy that instead of the justice of the sword, God allows for the people to change and shows them instead compassion and mercy. This past week, as Jews throughout the world observed the high holy days and prepared for the beginning of their new year, they reflected on the wrongs they've done and the way they've done them to others. They engaged in the practice of making amends for wrongs, of forgiving themselves and others so that they could begin anew in love. Yom Kippur also calls us to address the wrongs in our society as a whole, and engage in ways to restore the fabric of community rather than to seek revenge for wrongs committed. There's a wonderful Yom Kippur story in which a child asks her rabbi, "What does God pray for on Yom Kippur?" And the rabbi replies, "God prays, may my capacity for mercy be greater than my capacity for justice." Now that's the story of Jonah, isn't it? It's the essence of the message that I want to share with you this morning. When we bring the teachings of Yom Kippur together with our second principle, we see something about those abstract words. We affirm and promote justice, equity, and compassion in human relationships. We see that it can be a real tension between justice and compassion. Not that abstract idea of justice, but the kind of justice we often demand when we are victims of crime or when we've been wronged by others. The justice that demands a pound of flesh, the eye for an eye kind of justice that is found in that very same Bible that gives us the story of Jonah. We have a right to expect that people make amends for wrongs they do. We have a right to protect our society from wrongdoers and impose penalties for wrongful acts. Penalties which can deter others and prevent them, same thing, from happening again. But if this quest for justice is not tempered by compassion, we as individuals live consumed with anger and self-righteousness, and we as a society become excessively harsh and waste so much human potential. The message of Yom Kippur and our second principle is that justice has to be tempered by mercy or compassion. Now that idea found, of course, in the book of Jonah was eloquently captured by Shakespeare when in The Merchant of Venice, Portia, the play's heroine, says, "The quality of mercy is not strained. It droppeth as the gentle rain from heaven upon the place beneath. It is twice blessed. It blesses him that gives and him that takes. 'Tis mightiest in the mightiest, It becomes the throne monarch better than his crown. His scepter shows the force of temporal power, the attribute of awe and majesty, wherein doth sit the dread and fear of kings. But mercy is above this sceptered sway. It's enthroned in the hearts of kings. It's an attribute to God himself. An earthly power doth then show likest gods when mercy seasons justice. Therefore, though justice be thy plea, consider this, that in the course of justice, none of us should see salvation. We do pray for mercy, and that same prayer doth teach us all to render the deeds of mercy. Well, I guess old Will Shakespeare knew the story of Jonah. And I guess this tension between justice and mercy or compassion has been around for a real long time. But you know, nowhere in our society today is that tension between justice and compassion more evident than in our criminal justice system. Nowhere is the need to temper justice with mercy more profound. I spent 8 years of my life as a prosecutor, a DA, and another 12 years where my principal practice was criminal defense work. I've seen the system from both sides. I've seen where it promotes real justice and where it does just the opposite. When I began trying cases in the criminal courts, judges had a great deal of discretion in sentencing. With the exception of a few of the most serious crimes, there were no mandatory sentences. They, the judges, were able to consider what was really just in the particular situation and able to show compassion where appropriate. But during my years in the court system and until recently, there has been an increasing momentum to set harsher and harsher mandatory sentences for more and more crimes at both the state and federal level. We're now in this ridiculous position where people are sentenced to jail for life who have never committed a violent offense, and others who are serving 20 or more years for first-time drug offenses or even two or three minor offenses. The Russian writer Dostoevsky wrote, "The degree of civilization in a society can be judged by entering the prisons." And for a few minutes this morning, I want to do that. I want to enter those prisons with you and examine with you whether we're living up to the teachings of our second principle, up to the teachings of the story of Jonah or the words of Shakespeare. Presently, there are close to 2.5 million adults in jail in the U.S., another 4.5 million on parole or probation, bringing the total to 7 million people under the control of the correctional system. The accelerating rate of incarceration over the past few decades, which some now call those decades the punishing decades, is just as startling as the number that I just recited about the people in jail. In 1980, there were about 220 people incarcerated for every 100,000 Americans. By 2010, the number had tripled to 731 per 100,000. From 1920 to 2006, the U.S. population grew 2.8 times larger, but the number of those incarcerated grew by 20 times. No other country in the world even approaches this. In the past two decades, the money that states spent on prisons has risen at a rate 6 times greater than the spending on higher education has. The stories of individuals throughout this country in the prison system are, in my opinion, shocking. Mothers who, in some small way, assisted an abusive boyfriend dealing drugs and now never get to see their children grow up. Teenagers who get involved with drugs and then sell some to support their habit have gone to jail, and they will be there until they are middle-aged. Even judges, and I've seen this, who don't want to give these sentences, who even say on the record, "So, but their hands are tied. The consequences of this mandatory sentencing mania has been devastating to individuals who may well be good candidates for rehabilitation and to their families. The waste of human potential with all those people in jail, most of whom could be productive members of society again, is sickening. The cost of this massive prison system at both the state and federal level is bankrupting governments. And also, something not often observed, but the present sentencing procedure has essentially turned the power of sentencing over to prosecutors, as they can actually control the length of the sentence based on the types and the number of charges they bring against an individual, when the judge has no discretion in the sentences. But there actually is some good news. You know, sometimes the right thing can happen for the wrong reasons. And that's what I think we're seeing now. Primarily because of the cost that's bankrupting governments, the attorney generals and members of Congress from both parties are now proposing legislation to reduce or get rid of many of these mandatory sentences. Doing so would allow justice to be tempered by compassion and return the role of formulating the just penalty for a crime to a judge who's allowed to take in all the factors. I believe that our second principle calls us to vigorously support this reform, but for deeper reasons than just the dollars involved. But we don't have to be engaged with the criminal justice system to apply the second principle. Like all our principles, it applies equally to how we live our individual lives. We've all been wronged sometime, treated unjustly, and surely we've done that same thing to others. If we live lives of seeking that kind of justice that looks more like revenge and refuse to show compassion in those situations where we've been hurt, we may make others' lives miserable. But so too will be ours. We'll be stuck in our anger, unable to move forward. Justice is important, but compassion is what is the key to moving forward with your life. Likewise, when we've done wrong to another, we need to commit to not doing that wrong again and to seek forgiveness of the other person, and we need to then show compassion towards ourselves as well. When we're really hurt and angry, showing compassion does not come easily. You know, perhaps you've gone through a tough divorce. Perhaps you've grown up in an abusive family. Perhaps you've been the victim of a crime or of bullying or ridicule. Perhaps you've been treated really unfairly in your workplace. Perhaps you've been the victim of discrimination. Every one of those things is someone here in this parish's story. Every one of them. None of them are right. Every one of them demands justice. But then, we have to come to the point where we temper our demands for justice with our willingness to show compassion. As I was writing this sermon, I remembered a true story, which some of you heard before because, like my good stories, they recycle every now and then. But it, I think, really illustrates the point, so I want to share it with you. It begins with a horrible drive-by shooting. It's a true story. An innocent young man, the only son of a loving mother, is shot and killed. He was not the intended victim. He was just in the wrong place at the wrong time. The young man who killed him was caught, went to court, was convicted of the crime, and as is the custom in our court system, before the judge imposed the sentence, he asked for a victim statement, in this case the victim's mother, if she wished to say anything, and she said yes. And she took the stand and she looked at the young man who killed her son and she pointed her finger at him and she said, "I'm going to kill you." And he was sentenced to a long time in prison. And after several years, this still very angry and distraught mother decided she was going to go to that prison just once to speak to that man, give him her mind, who had killed her son. She needed to know more. She wanted to know what kind of person could have done this to her. And when she got to the jail, she learned that he never got visitors. So she, face to face, asked him, "How come your gang buddies don't come see you?" "I don't know," he said. After a time, she left the prison. But for some reason, she had to go back again, and she continued to visit. A while later, as the date for his release neared, she visited again. And she said, "What are you going to do when you get out of prison? You're going to need a job." He said, "I don't know." Well, she said, "I know someone's got a construction company, and you look good and strong. Do you want me to ask if he can give you a job?" He said, "Sure." As the date for his release became even closer, she went to the prison again. She said to him, "You're going to need a place to live when you get out of jail. Where are you going to live?" "I don't know," he said. She said, "Well, I have an extra room in my house. It was my son's room. I guess you could live there." Well, he got out of jail, and he went to work, and he lived with the woman. He helped her maintain the house, and he lived a good life, worked the construction job, and nothing was ever said about the tragedy that had brought them together, until one day. When the mother called him into a parlor room, it was a room that was not used in the house except for special occasions, and she said to him, "You remember that day in court?" And he said, "Yes." And she said, "Do you remember what I said to you?" And he said, "Yes, you said you were going to kill me." She said, "That's right. And I did. The young man who killed my son is dead. And the man you are today is someone whom I'd be proud to call my son." Well, most of the time, the events of our life where we're called to balance justice and mercy like that situation are not as tough or as dramatic as that one. Whether it is how we as a society treat those who've done wrong, or how we as individuals respond to situations where we've been personally wronged, the teachings of Yom Kippur and the teachings of this faith tradition, as expressed in that second principle, require the very same thing of us. Yes, to seek justice, but to temper it with compassion. We cannot let our love be too narrow. We have to love and show compassion where it's hard to love. We cannot live by our zealous righteousness or our rigid concepts of tit for tat. As the saying goes, eye for an eye justice eventually ends up with two blind people. Of course, there must be steps to make things right. There needs to be action to deter others from committing crimes. We all know that there have to be consequences to our actions. But justice must always be tempered by mercy. On this Yom Kippur, on this Sunday when we direct our thoughts to our second principle, affirming and promoting justice, equity, and compassion in human relationships, my hope is that our prayer will be the same as what the rabbi told that young girl was God's prayer on Yom Kippur. May our capacity for compassion be greater than our capacity for justice. Our words of benediction are among my favorite. They're from Frederick Gillis. May the love which overcomes all differences, which heals all wounds, which puts to flight all fears, which reconciles all those who are separated, be in us and among us this day and always. Amen. I invite you now to sing to each other a benediction, the words of which are found in your order of service.